Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
Hello, and welcome to Design Chats, a new podcast series from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Caligaris, Vice President of Marketing and Product Strategy at Pragmatic Institute. And you'll notice that I am not a designer. And so I'm super excited today to talk to Adam Cutler, who is a distinguished designer at IBM and a founding member of IBM Design, and just someone who I think has spent a lot of time and energy focusing not just on what makes great design, but how do you build really, really strong design teams? And as you know, for me as a non-designer, but someone on the business side, like that's what we're looking for. You're looking for that really good partnership where everybody's expertise comes to the table, because that's where exciting things really happen. So welcome, Adam. We are extremely excited to have you on today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
All right. First, for our listeners, you give a little context, like what sparked your passion for design? How did you get into the design space and what do you love about it?
Well, I wish we could talk about that for the entire time. So I got interested in design without knowing I was interested in design at a fairly early age. I remember a couple key things. One was, we had some friends who had some mid-century modern furniture in their house, and I just remember being enamored with it for no particular reason other than it spoke in some deep language to me that was like, it was unlike all of the colonial and antique furniture that was in my house growing up. I just, you know, seeing an Eames lounger was just like, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. And I didn't really understand why. And then the other thing that was really probably the most seminal thing for me was my parents took me to see Star Wars when I was 7 years old. And if you're younger, or, you know, there's no explaining what life was like before Star Wars, because everything is sort of patterned after that. But back when Star Wars came out, they didn't have the merchandising machines in place for any of this stuff. So the toys weren't there, whatever. And there were like two posters that you could buy, and that was it. And so I had this like poster of Darth Vader that hung on my ceiling, and I would look at like all the buttons and stuff on his chest, and I would get to wondering, like, I wonder what that button does, and I wonder why that's where it's placed. And then, you know, when you could finally rewatch the movie, I remember thinking to myself, like, well, why is the switch like that? Or why was that designed that way? And, you know, without using those words, but I just had this interest in, why did somebody choose to put a certain thing in a certain place? Why did they color it that way? Why did they do that to make it hide or pop out? And as I got older, I realized that I couldn't picture myself in a 9-to-5 job where I sat in some cubicle and crunched numbers or something like that. I wanted to do something that was creative, and, you know, my parents were not keen on me being a starving artist. So I figured that the best way to merge these two ideas together would be to get into advertising, because I could be creative and artistic in that way and make money. So when I went to school, I dual majored in psychology and advertising. And my grand plan at the time was, well, if I understand how people think, it's going to give me an insight in how to message to people and to be more effective that way. And when I came out of school, the web wasn't a thing. And so when the modern internet came around, to me, it was like, oh, I've been waiting for this moment my entire life. It was sort of a little bit science fiction. It was a very large DIY component to the early internet, where, you know, it wasn't all corporate and it wasn't platforms or anything like that. It was people figuring out how to design for this new medium. And there was just one interesting thing that led to another, that I had all this great experience in advertising. You know, I got to work with Michael Jordan shooting TV commercials. And, you know, as a 23-year-old in Chicago, like every client I worked on was like beer, cigarettes, booze, or sports teams. I mean, it was just like the greatest, right? You know, didn't pay anything, but I got to work on all these things that I loved. And I was able to hone one of my key skills, which was you have to be able to get an idea across. And that if you can't get the idea across before it gets made, then you don't have a chance of actually getting it out there. So learning how to articulate why the idea was going to hit the mark or why it meant something in particular to the project at hand was something that I had some of the greatest people teaching me, both trial by fire, as well as, you know, showing me what to do or how to do it. But it was when a couple friends from college rang me up and they said, hey, we ran a T1 line into our basement, which was like the fastest internet that you could get. And it was like obscenely expensive. And they said, what if we could take credit cards safely over the internet so that you could shop from home and just have stuff show up? And we ended up creating one of the very first e-commerce portals at the very beginning of e-commerce. And one of the things that they had reached out to me about, given my advertising experience, was figuring out what our Christmas holiday stunt was going to be. How are we going to get on people's radar? And to make a long story short, we ended up pulling off the first ever e-commerce transaction from outer space with the Mir Cosmonauts that year. And we had we got a little bid on us on Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live and all that. And I was hooked. And from there, we started a consulting firm and then, you know, around e-commerce. And then we all had to go our separate ways because of life. There was like children being born and people getting married. So we all went in our separate directions. I went and worked at an e-commerce or like an internet consultancy called IXL, which ended up getting merged in with Razorfish. And then that went a little south after the dot-coms imploded and IBM was across the street and somebody came in and said, hey, they're interested in all of us as designers. And so I went and talked to them and I thought, well, I'll be out of here in 2 years. This is just a port in a storm. And here it is 21 years later and I keep getting to do cool stuff. So I love it here.
That's awesome. I love that story. I do think of people of a certain age, of which it's both of our ages, right? Like you didn't grow up being like, I'm going to be a UX designer because like we didn't have those things. But what I found really interesting as you talked through your story were the factors and things that you just like that you had, right? So thinking about the chair story and the Star Wars, you were interested in both the aesthetic and the function early, right? Then you go to college and you're like, I'm gonna do psychology because you cared about the human, right? And then advertising gives you that goal and to be fair, the monetization piece.
Yeah.
It gives you that full circle, which means that when the world fundamentally changed and the web was born, you had that sort of the full set of skills, but also interest and passion that really makes this role for you just a great connection point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could kind of say that my entire career has been like a series of perfect storms and me standing in the right spot at the right time and getting really lucky a whole bunch.
Yes. Well, lucky that you can, and then the passion to really pull through. Yeah. And I would think at being at IBM for 21 years, that as you saw the evolution in your career, the evolution of design in IBM, as well as in the industry as a whole, and sort of even IBM's role in that has got to have evolved immensely.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I almost quit my job at IBM at the end of the first week I was there. I went to a meeting where I just come, like I finished my training. I went and met with some users down in New Jersey. I get back to Boston and I find out that there's a team already coding a solution. And I went over to them and I said, I'm curious what you're coding because I just got back from talking to the users. If I'm the first person to talk to the users, what are you making? And this engineer looks at me deadpan, no joking around. And he says, oh, you have it all wrong. You're just here to make things look pretty on the way out the door. Ooh. And I winced a little bit and I went back to my desk and I thought, well, maybe this place isn't for me. And then I looked at my situation, a 6-month-old daughter, I can't just quit and go try to find another job. So I decided to approach this as a design problem. And what I realized was people didn't understand what design really was. They equated it to like visual design or graphic design, you know, font choices and what you mock up in Photoshop or Illustrator. And I had to get the point across that it is about addressing a deeper human need and understanding what people need to be successful, and then planning for that, and then architecting a solution around what those people need versus technology first, and then just try to make it look good and work good after the fact. So that was kind of an important point at the beginning of my IBM career. And honestly, it's what put me here in this seat today, doing what I'm doing today, is that I kept at telling that story over and over. And the more people I got to listen to me, started to see the reason behind what I was trying to get across, that it wasn't just what it looked like on the outside, but it was the reason for existing on the inside. And I mean, that's part of the reason why I've had all these opportunities, is that I explained it really well and people started figuring out like, oh, people will pay attention to this, especially when I was in the consulting side of the business. The clients didn't necessarily know that they wanted or needed design. Mm-hmm. But I figured out that once I had honed my story down to a certain point, that if I could get in within the first 2 speakers of any pitch meeting or anything like that, I could change the entire direction to get everybody talking about design as opposed to what was the technological wonder that they were in for that day.
And it's really interesting because, we think, okay, that was 21 years ago. But I know, speaking and doing research here, that there are absolutely designers listening to this right now who are having that same struggle, that they're put in a box where it's like you're at the end and you make it pretty, and they're really trying to beat that drum internally, to do what you did and help them really see the impact. So I would love to talk a little bit more in detail about how you did that. And I also, just out of curiosity, wonder if, having spent time in the consulting side, if some of the impact that the clients and the consultancy brought in helped IBM like self-reflect in that this could work for them as well, or was it more of an extension of what you'd already built in?
I think it was more of a combination of a number of things. So I had built up my reputation for being able to get across why design was important to our clients. And as a result of doing that over and over again, you would be in the room with certain important people for certain important clients. And they would hear my pitch for the first time. And then some other client that was at a much higher level or connected to some other deeper part of the business that wasn't through consulting, but they were coming and asking about design. And so somebody somewhere would say, oh, I've heard Cutler's thing, you should have him come and talk. And so back in 2012, when Phil Gilbert was named the first general manager of design for IBM, obviously my name came up. And so it was, that opportunity to create IBM design as an organization, as a formalized movement inside of IBM, was wholly because of what Phil was able to bring from his experience and from what he did when he joined IBM. But I was brought in as designer number one into the program to help bridge the gap into all the different parts of IBM. I knew how to, for lack of a better way of putting it, speak like an IBMer. And I think it was this combination, not just of Phil and I, but of a number of people. There were probably about 10 of us that were from different parts of the business that we all came together with our own unique perspective. And again, this is one of those perfect storms where you have the right people in the right place at the right time. And we were just audacious enough to pull off something that, I mean, when I heard Phil was named the GM of design, I was like, oh, this poor gentleman is going to be run out on a rail in about a half an hour. This company doesn't take design seriously. And here we are, all these years later. And I think we're one of the biggest, if not the biggest, standalone design competency in the corporate world. In my wildest dreams back in 2001, I could not have pictured what we are today. I mean, I couldn't have even imagined it. That's just something that you dream about.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing story. So when you think about both the early years and then when Phil came on board, be advocating and helping to talk about and demonstrate the impact of design? What are some of the things for those listening who need to do it internally? What are some advice you would give them?
Okay, so first, and this is an important one, I think a lot of people who are stuck in that design box that you were talking about earlier, that, you know, you're at the end of the train, make it look pretty, they feel that they are in a fight and they approach it as a fight. Mm. And when you fight, you're fighting City Hall in this case, and you're never going to change minds by fighting. It's about figuring out how to articulate the message properly. And so one of the things that I learned early on was, if I spoke about design as it related to simply to software or to whatever that problem was that somebody came in through the door with, it gave them all of the places to say, you don't understand our business, you don't understand our industry, and you don't understand what we're trying to do here. But when I started explaining design by pointing out all of the things in their homes that they probably never considered were to be designed to, and that they purchased it and placed it in their home as something that, you know, was more than just the vacuum cleaner that you bought or the coffee cup that you had in the cupboard, but that there was a reason why you ended up with that one and not another one, or why that one article in your house that you just can't stand and you've been looking and looking and looking for that great thing. You know, once you take the focus off of software and you get them to understand that they do care about design and it's everywhere around them, then they relax a little bit and they don't know exactly where you're going, because here they are talking to a big software company and yet this guy's up here talking about like coffee cups and vacuum cleaners. And then I bring in the psychology of it. You know, I show them a picture of Maslow's hierarchy and I basically say, you know, human needs don't change. I mean, Maslow's hierarchy has been updated, but that thing is from the 40s. But our general needs as human beings don't change, but the tools that we make to serve those needs change all the time. And there's progress and there's better ways of solving for that problem. And then you show them a bunch of things that they have in their house. And then you start explaining that people just want it to work. Whatever it is, people just have the expectation that it should just work. And they don't really care what you have to go through. They don't care what the org chart looks like for your business. They don't care about whether or not you have a good working relationship between the different groups in your organization. All they care about is the thing that they're interacting with does the job that it's supposed to, and that it puts a tiny smile on their face. I mean, it doesn't have to be like, oh, wow, every time, but it has to serve some purpose that fills us up somehow. And then I came up with this exercise that just sort of knocked people back. And in doing that in a very short period of time, especially if it was just that exercise, I could change an entire room's point of view in 6 minutes. And it's pretty simple. I would say to the room, you know, I post-it notes all over the place in Sharpies. And I'd say, I'm going to take 3 minutes here and I want you to design a vase. And everybody would look at me like I was from another planet. And then they would say and complain, I can't draw. And, you know, we all know what a vase looks like. And I would just say, just, you can write it down. You can, you know, write it in prose or describe it or draw it, whatever you need to do. And while they're doing that, and I have a timer up there and it ticks down faithfully, here's the entire 3 minutes. And meanwhile, I'm drawing like three of the most common vases that are out there. And so the time ends and I say, okay, take that post-it note off the top. I want you to hold it up over your head, and everyone does it. And then I said, now I want you to crumple that and throw it wherever it lands, because I don't care what you just drew. And everybody laughs. And I say, because it looks like one of these. And if you did something that was a little more exciting than that, then I apologize. But now I want to do this. I want to take another 3 minutes and I want you to design a better way for people to enjoy flowers in their home. And you can hear everybody's skulls cracking open. And I'm teaching them a few things in this very short period of time. One, I'm teaching them the basics of design thinking, in which you can come up with as many ideas as you can. Ideas on a post-it note are inherently tossable, and that you'll always come up with another idea or a better idea if somebody doesn't like your idea. I'm also teaching them about how to reframe a problem. And when we're done, everybody is very excited to share what they have to say. And it's amazing how people on opposite sides of the room who aren't talking with one another are coming up with very similar solutions to a common problem. And then there are others that come up with the solutions that aren't the same, but they're very cohesive, or they merge nicely with another one. So what you're showing people is like, if you're willing to explore the possibilities behind a solution, then the opportunity for these ideas to come together feels more like we're playing because we simply reframe the problem space. And once you do that, then you say, okay, well, if we can do that for a vase, why can't we do the same thing for whatever problem you're here for? And that just, it gets everybody to loosen up and they go, well, I think this might be fun. And then you can start asking questions like, how much do you know about your users? Okay, well, we have a design thinking exercise that's just focused on getting to know your users a little bit. And is that as good as knowing your users, like doing primary user research? No, it's not, but at least it opens the possibility of somebody saying, we should probably take a couple months and go do actual interviews with our users because we guessed at a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. That's a perfectly acceptable thing. So again, going back to the original question, getting people there isn't necessarily about fighting for your position as a designer or the importance of design. It's about, in some ways, tricking people into understanding that it isn't as bad or as soft or as fluffy as people might expect it to be, and that there is a purpose behind it. And that once they start seeing these patterns emerge, they're much more willing to go along with it. And then I think it's down to us when it comes to the question of craft, which is different from design thinking, like actual design craft. Mm-hmm. Means that we have to have the talent to back up all of that stuff, right? Like we can't just get people moving and then be like, okay, well, we'll make it look pretty on the way out the door. We play right into the stereotype. It means that we have to be on point with everything that we do from a craft perspective so that we're able to pay off on all of those intermediate steps to the point where it actually goes out the door.
Love that. So in some ways, I would say that what you focused was less on designers' value, right? Designers matter, and more on design, the value of design in a big thinking. You zoomed it out. So A, that kind of keeps the turf war away, and it inspires people. And to your point, like you inspire people because it's kind of a big promise, right? In a way, because we all know the difference between a product that just works for us and one that you're like, oh, I have to do this again. And to your point, you also have to then have the team who delivers on that.
That's right.
But I think it's really powerful because I do think we often are like, oh, I'll help them understand. We'll do a roles and responsibilities. Like we'll be really focused here. And if they can't see the big vision, I think that'd be hard.
Yeah, well, it's also interesting too, because when we look at it through the lens of roles and responsibilities, everything gets provincial. And it's not just our domain as designers. What I mean by that is design isn't just our domain. That I will argue that some of the most creative and thoughtful design responses have come from software developers and engineers. And one of the things that I was very adamant about at the beginning of our program was that we were going to strike the word creative from any job title. So no creative directors or ECDs or things like that, because somehow that's our space. And again, like, you know, because of years of being pigeonholed like that, you'd hear engineers say like, oh, well, that's the creative team. You know, that's their job. And it's just patently untrue. Everybody is creative. Everybody has that opportunity. So by making sure that we're not locking ourselves in based on the roles, or more to the point, I guess, locking responsibilities to a role makes it easier for us to work together when everybody is co-opted into that design process. It doesn't matter what your skill set is or what it says on your business card. It's whether or not you can play nice with one another. And if you can get people to play nice with one another, then that natural flow of, well, what if, and oh, we could try this, or hey, I went home and I tried to get this working overnight. What do you think about that? And then having people change their direction and recalibrate based on what somebody else is able to bring to the table. I think that's very important.
But I think like you made the sort of clear the difference earlier, but there's design thinking, which you want to permeate everywhere, because again, creativity is everywhere. The thinking is everywhere. It's an approach to things, and really focusing on building that out gives space then where the designers doing the design work can do differently. When you think of building a good design team and the type of talent you want to attract, what are sort of the key things that you're like, to deliver on this promise, I need people who are X?
So that's an interesting question, because there isn't a great one size fits all answer to that. when we started our program, we looked at everybody who had design in their title that were currently working at IBM. And there were something like, I don't know, I want to say 400 out of close to 400,000 people in the company. Oh, wow. at the time. So not much. And some people were just design managers. They weren't actively practicing design. They were just wrangling other designers. And then there were a lot of people who were designers who were really like reduced to being icon monkeys, like make this button, make this image for that button. You know, they weren't really designing. They were just doing like UI polish. And so when we were figuring out what it meant to design for the type of designer that I've been talking about, that person who's searching for the intent behind the things that we make, we didn't exactly know what an IBM designer was at the time, but we sourced that first cohort of 60 designers that were all fresh out of school, some out of their master's program, some out of their undergraduate, based on the quality of their work and how they presented themselves. So we were looking at, you know, like, can you present your work and be articulate and be convincing about it? And, you know, was the quality and the craft of the work good? And when we got them together, that first group was so eclectic that I don't know that we could necessarily say that any of them were like the IBM designer. They were all that prototype, that mixture, and how they worked together coming from all these different programs started to give us a sense of what we needed to be successful at IBM. And one of the things that we realized is the lone wolf designer was not something that was desirable at IBM because it's so big, the company is so big, because design was at the time fighting from behind. There wasn't a lot of demand for it or desire for it. And so if you bring in a lone wolf, they actually further, for us, they furthered the one stereotype that we didn't want to further, which was, you know, don't worry about it, leave it to me, I'm going to handle all of this. We needed people who were team players. And more important, we needed people who had both the aptitude and the curiosity to understand the business that they were getting placed into. And I think it's important to note here that there isn't one design team at IBM because we're so big and the company is so varied and spread across the globe that there isn't a centralized design function. I'm part of the design program office and our job is to make sure that design propagates throughout the company, which is great. But then there are others who are on a product team. So they're working on an IBM software product. And then we have others who are working in the office of the CIO and they're designing for all of us at IBM. And then there are others still who are either in IBM research doing advanced research and prototyping, or we have others who are in the consulting business who are doing the same thing for our customers. And each one has their nuance. But what we were trying to find in the pattern was that aptitude to understand a deeper problem, the ability to say something with respect, but to disagree when the problem as stated was different than the problem as understood. And that meant sometimes that a very young, early career professional designer would be going toe-to-toe with somebody who was a senior vice president. And as long as they weren't jerks about it and they were convincing, what we saw was that the senior vice presidents would actually listen to these young designers. And so we started to figure out for ourselves what that IBM designer looked like. And then after we honed in on it and we knew how to recruit for the types of designers that we wanted, we were able to codify that in our career playbook. So, you know, it's basically a map that says, you know, if you start here at the very beginning, this is what it looks like when you end up as a design fellow or like an IBM fellow in design, you know, over a, you know, say a 15 to 20 year period at IBM. That helped people understand how they fit into the greater whole, even though each one of us approaches our jobs fairly differently. We all hum a similar tune. And that's through the practices and the things that we've created for our design community, whether it's the IBM design language or carbon framework or enterprise design thinking or the stuff that I'm doing with design for AI. All of these are there to give people that framework to fit themselves into, but also maintain their business unit's individuality, for lack of a better way of putting it, to do what they need to do for that part of the business.
And the personalities of their team and those kind of things.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it sounds like a great environment. And you talk about, I think you have a path for them. You also talked about like letting the business understand design one of the things we found, and when we've talked to designers and their research is often that when they're right out of design school, they understand design, but they don't necessarily understand business, right? Is yes. part of that path you lay out kind of, we help the business understand design, but we also help designers understand the business and the levers that matter there.
Yes, that is absolutely true. In fact, we have a few different programs and publications that we make available to our designers. One of them is called The Business of Design, and it's getting them to understand how IBM's business operates, where mm-hmm. they fit in, and then helping them understand the basic terms and ideas behind how the business runs and how design plugs into these various spaces within the company. So I think there's the actual training and the materials that we give them. But I also think that it's also giving people the freedom to be curious and to reconnect with curiosity. Because for a lot of us, the further we get away from our childhood, the more curiosity gets beaten out of us. It's not something to be enhanced or nourished. It's something that we try to make go away. And we bring that back. So one is curiosity. And the other one is to be A-okay with ignorance. Like if you don't know something, to put your hand up and say, I need you to explain this to me like I'm 5 years old. And what we found is that when you get somebody to explain it like they're explaining it to a five-year-old, is that there are other people who have been in the business for 10 years. Mm-hmm. They'll say, oh my God, that's how it works? I never knew that. And it just opens up this avenue of like, oh, I don't have to pretend to be something that I'm not. Yes. I can be okay with saying, I'm great at design. This is a new space for me. Can you teach me the basics of this so that I can bring what I know to what you know? And over the course of time, those two things come closer together much easier because there's just a certain degree of vulnerability that comes with ignorance and curiosity.
I was thinking that too. It's a trust mechanism. If you feel yeah. comfortable saying, I don't know, to me, that really lowers my levels of fear that I can do it reciprocal. Can I be like, oh, why do you think that this should be designed this way? Like, help me understand. And it's helped me understand. It's not defend, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's
ways we should approach conversations with everybody. But don't always do that. That is
the other thing that we do, and we have done from the beginning when we brought on those first 60 designers, we don't drip them into the business. Like as we hire somebody, we then bring them on board. We actually start all of our designers as a cohort, regardless of where they are on the planet, regardless of what their discipline within design is, they all come together on the same day and they go through, it used to be 20 weeks. I think it's now 12 weeks. But they all start on the same day. And we used to call it like the lost semester of college. And we tried to teach them what they needed to know to be the best IBM designer they could be before they actually joined the team that they were going to when they started doing their actual work. And so we would try to cover off on things that they may not have been exposed to in school. So one is definitely teamwork. Most people in design school, mm-hmm. it's a solitary sport, right? And that they have a hard time working with each other at first because that's not what they're used to. It's not about competing for the best grade in the class anymore. It's about, are we all going to cross the finish line at the same time? And are we going to do it with high quality? So we're teaching them things about like accessibility, you know, for one, giving them a focused week on accessibility and all aspects of accessibility. Mm-hmm. We're teaching them design thinking. And then we do basically like an incubator program in which we source from the business opportunities for them to leapfrog either their own development cycles or to get them out of what they're usually doing from a project planning perspective. And then they get exposure to real business problems with real business executives, and they have to present it as if they were on a team. And it's a nice practice run before mm-hmm. they actually go out into yep. the business to get them comfortable. And then the benefit of all of this is that if everyone back when we were able to do this in person, the pandemic has prevented us from doing it up until this point, everybody would come here to Austin, Texas to be a part of this. And then they would take back to whatever their home studio was, mm-hmm. wherever they're going back, all the cultural things that happen in the Austin studio, which is the flagship. They take back all the cultural stuff. But then they also have a cohort of somewhere between 80 and 90 people that all started on the same day that are in different parts of the business. And that if they ever are curious about what's going on the consulting side or on the product side, they have friends that they can reach out to. And if they get stuck, there's people that they can reach out to for support. And all of these things together just makes it so much easier for our designers to thrive. And I think that's one of the most important things. If you feel like you're fighting all the time, you're not thriving, you're just surviving. And if you're thriving, you're like clicking your heels every day you get out of bed. You're like, I can't believe people pay me money to go do this job, which is exactly what we want.
You know, it's interesting because as a marketing person, and I have an advertising background as well, most of the first software companies I came to, I started on a team and you had to prove that you were the good kind of marketing and not the one they thought you were, that like only did tchotchkes, right? Like every single one you had to wait, you had to say your strategic and thorough. And it was very frustrating for me, but it would also be, I'm sure, very frustrating for my teammates who felt like they were training the new one to some degree. And I would think the same way. You guys having such a well planned onboarding for designers means that you're not asking those functional teams to do that. What you are providing to those functional teams is a level of consistency and preparedness that they can kind of trust and go with, right? They're like, oh, good, they sent me another well-trained designer, and not, oh, look, this one has to prove it and I have to train him up. And I think from that tension perspective as well, you really eliminate a lot of that in a pretty spectacular way.
Yeah, and I think something else that helped with that. So the best way to think of these boot camps is it gives them the running start. They're not joining their team at a standstill, but that they're already moving. They sort of have the pacing and the understanding of what's being asked of them. They still need to be onboarded to their team because their team has a very specific culture and a very specific purpose. I think it's very important that when a new designer joins the team that they're going to, that they feel like they can contribute. Because part of it is just the confidence. If you don't have that confidence, then it makes it really difficult. And it also takes strain off of the receiving team or the team that's bringing the designer on, because they know that they don't have to spend all this time getting them there. It's really about showing them, like, this is the lay of the land. You already know what you need to know behaviorally. This is what you need to know tactically about our business. And at the beginning, the design program office did all the hiring for all the designers because we weren't sure that the hiring function within IBM could do this justice. And when it got to a point where we were able to capture a lot of the ideals around what an IBM designer looked like, we were then able to push that hiring function back out into the business. So it's no longer centralized, because any given team knows what they want as their IBM designer. They can go look for the people that fit their mold or their specific brand, whatever that might be. That gives them a little more control over the types of people that they're bringing in, because they know their culture better than we ever will.
But it's also a testament to how well you've created this program, that they recognize the pieces they want, but they're building it on the foundation that you've established as this is critical, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. If it's okay, I want to go a little bit different because I find this super interesting. So we talked about how far technology's come when you started, right? Like we didn't grow up. I can fascinate my daughter all the time with the things I didn't have when I was a kid. But, you know, so from not having the web to web was huge, but now you've been doing a lot of design work sort of in the AI space. And I think that's super fascinating. And I would love just kind of thinking about, you know, design when you think of artificial intelligence and sort of how you approach that.
Well, when I first started on this process, you know, basically the prompt was given to me, figure out what it means to design for AI, full stop. Not Watson, not any particular brand, but just if you're a designer and you're working with AI, what does that mean? And I knew enough to be dangerous in a bad way, not in the good way. Like I needed to get a whole lot smarter. And so the first year of that, I just went and talked to as many people as I could, both inside and outside the company. And what I came to realize are a small handful of things. One is it's so easy for people to say, let's stick AI in this, you know, let's put Watson in this. It's very easy to say those words. And people don't really understand how much work needs to be done. And this was coming off of the really big swell of mobile development. Like mobile apps were sort of like a curiosity at first in the same way that the web was. And then it made it past a certain point and everyone was like, oh, there's money to be made making custom apps. And then all of this infrastructure popped up around, you know, like we can get you from a scribble on a whiteboard to a working mobile app in 6 weeks. And I think there's a lot of that mentality that was there at the beginning, which is like, oh, well, there's all these AI things that are out there right now. So in 6 weeks, we'll be up and running. And it's like, well, who's your data scientist? And everybody sort of looks around the room at each other and they go, well, we don't have a data scientist. And we're like, well, how are you going to do AI then if you don't have a data scientist? So first thing I learned was easy to say, let's do AI. Mm-hmm. Second thing I learned is traditionally, if you're designing for digital, most of what you're designing, you know, the activities that you perform, regardless of what your discipline within the design sphere is, you're usually making artifacts so that eventually a front-end developer can take all of these artifacts and build whatever it is that you're planning on building and get it up onto the glass. When you're designing for artificial intelligence, instead of designing what you design, all these artifacts, and you're making them not instead of for a front-end developer, you're really making them for a data scientist. And so this led me to understand that as an AI designer, it means that our data literacy has to grow exponentially. We have to understand the importance of, well, first you have to understand what data actually is. Then what are the things that you can do with data? How can you start getting clever and creative using data? And these are things that we have to build and grow over time because this is relatively new for all of us. The modern era of AI is only about a decade old and nobody really has it sorted out yet. You know, we're all still figuring this out. The other thing that I spotted almost immediately was the human was missing from a lot of this. It was all focused on, can we actually make this AI do what we want it to do? And is it solving the problems that we want to solve for? And the human and the human needs around AI was being left alone at the very least. And as I was doing my rounds and talking to experts all over the place, I was talking to one fellow in IBM and he was explaining to me that for a system to be considered artificially intelligent, it has to be able to understand, learn, reason, and interact. And I was fascinated by this as a concept. And these are the pillars of human cognition. But I couldn't let it go. I was drawing it all over the place. And there was something that I just couldn't get at. And then it hit me one day as I was getting ready for work that, yes, these are the pillars of cognition, but they're also the reasons why we choose to form meaningful and lasting relationships from a human to human perspective. That if we can understand each other, if I can learn from you and reason about what you're saying, it doesn't mean I have to agree with you, but at the very least, I can understand and learn from you. And if I can do this through interacting, this is a reason for us to continue our conversation, to get together and to expand on whatever it is that we start with and to keep going with it. And that's when it hit me that these, you know, for these machines, for us to consider them artificially intelligent means that they have the basic building blocks for us to start creating meaningful, lasting relationships between a human and a machine. And that to me is what makes me wake up every day and go, I can't believe they pay me to think about this stuff, because that to me is the future of what we're all going to experience. And we have various aspects of this littered around us, right? Like I learned in this process that there's a psychological concept called the pathetic fallacy. It's the thing that causes us to name our cars or to beg and pray that after the paper that you've been working on, you know, when Microsoft Word crashes, that you're like, please, please, please recover this, right? We know inside that praying to our machines is not going to increase the odds, right? Or that we're going to have 5 more minutes left on our battery during a call or something like that. But it is deep-seated within us as human beings to project our psyche onto inanimate objects. And for the first time ever, we're able to give these inanimate objects the ability to respond back to us, and not to respond back to us in a deterministic programmed way, but in a way that it's actually trying to understand us. It's trying to reason through what it is that we're asking it. And so to me, that is the biggest and best scenario for human-centered design is like, it's not just a one-way street anymore. And it's not just the smoke and mirrors of using a cookie to say like, welcome back, Rebecca. And you're like, oh, my bank remembers me. And it's like, it's just storing a variable versus a machine that remembers what you talked about the last time and then says, hey, by the way, you know, maybe you're going to look up something, you know, you're using a banking app. And today you're going to talk to it about, you know, a lost ATM card. But towards the end of the conversation, maybe it says like, hey, we talked about refinancing your mortgage a couple months ago. I have some new rates. Would you like to hear about them? Like that it can remember and then bring something up that it thinks is relevant to you. Is this changes the game and it changes the nature of how we design for it. Because ultimately what this means is we need to know ourselves as human beings better than we've ever known ourselves before. Mm-hmm. We have to understand what motivates us, why we want to create and maintain a relationship, not just accept it as fact. Because these are things that we're not taught when we're in school. Like nobody teaches us, this is how you design a conversation. You learn it from listening to your parents and your siblings and your friends. And the same thing with making relationships. Some of us are great at it and some of us are terrible at it, but nobody ever says like, this is how a relationship forms. But for us designing these things, we have to be keenly aware of all of these different variables that go into how we as human beings relate to the machine. And one of my first experiences gave me all that I needed to know about it. There was one of those little SoftBank Pepper robots in our kitchen at the office. And it had a sign that on it that said, I've got Watson in me. And I was like, oh boy, this is exciting. And I was trying to figure out how to turn it on and I'm like tapping on its head. And so I'm like checking out like its eyes and it has the cameras in it. And it comes awake and it spins its head at me and it, you know, raises its hands and creepily waves at me. And for a guy who grew up with R2-D2, I was like, I am out of here. I don't want any part of this. And I got back to my desk and I was thinking to myself, like, why did you react like that? And it was like, it was everything that I didn't expect it to be. And so, you know, if we meet each other for the first time, I can see like, oh, you're smiling or, you know, you're interested in me or you want to shake my hand or something like that. We can see that through our body language and machines can't do that. So we have to design all of these things that we take for granted. We just hear like, oh, artificial intelligence is going to know what I need to know. You have to make all of these things. You have to design these things. And so understanding that from the data level up is, I mean, this is the juiciest design assignment I have ever had. It's also why I'm still here for 21 years.
Well, and if you think again, and that sort of kismet, your psychology background,
yeah,
super helpful, because it is really hard to break down the things that we do. Again, having a kid, I remember like trying to teach her how to read, right? And I'm like, there are just things you know how to do. I know how to tie my shoes. It takes a lot to break it down into steps. And then when you're designing it to be able to reflect that back, it's a lot. But it's, as you said, it's also super interesting because if instead Watson had responded to you as you would be expecting in a human, it would be just a really opening event, right? I mean, in a sort of crass comparison, when you know when you get automations and someone's like, Rebecca, you were here and you want this, and it feels so fake. And you're like, no, I'm not buying a mince toupee. That's silly. Why would you think I would do that? Whereas if it really understood and learned, that wouldn't be invasive. It would be incredibly helpful and really almost a partner for me in a way that I would appreciate. And I think that feels still as a consumer really far from where we are, but like such an exciting opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, in some respects, it is really far. And then in others, like when you see developments like GPT-3 and foundational models around conversation, it is getting closer, quicker. It is definitely not there yet. And I think the other thing that we as designers have to fight against, both in ourselves and in the people who are expecting the work, is that there's like 40 plus years of pop culture informing us about what AI is, and most of it is terrible and horrifying. From Metropolis, you know, Fritz Lang's Metropolis to The Matrix or The Terminator. And then there's also like, you know, BB-8 or R2-D2 or Samantha from the movie Her. Like, these are all really nice and wonderful versions of what AI could or should be, and yet still very far out of our grasp. We can make things that may end up approximating some of that, but definitely not what we come to expect just from like our media consumption. And so helping people to sift through what's real and what's doable today versus what's on the horizon versus what are some of the bigger bets that people are making around neurosymbology and artificial general intelligence. These are the things that generally would provide those movie-like experiences, but we're still very far away from most of that stuff. Now we just want to train something narrowly into the machine and have it be really good on one topic. You know, that's hard enough as it is.
I have to tell you though, I think I feel infinitely better and more positive with the idea of design playing a role, like being the bringing the human back into AI models. It not only does it scare, you know, it makes me think that Terminator is not coming, but it makes me see the promise of the technology in a very different way. And so I can see why you're super excited in that role. And I'm also just, again, super excited there is that role to do that. Seriously. Yeah.
And you know, I don't want to ignore this part, but a very large part of our work is centered on the ethics around designing for AI. And again, this is something that designers generally don't get trained in, right? We don't have ethics training, which we all should, because there are ethics in terms of how we introduce bias through our actual design solutions in many other mundane ways that have nothing to do with AI. But the potential problems multiply when we get into artificial intelligence, and having a point of view and having people who think deeply about this is really important, very important to me, because I think for the potential evils that AI might represent in the future, I think there will always be bad actors and there will be some that are deliberately made to be malicious. I think what we really have to worry about are the situations where it was unintended. It wasn't malicious. It just happened because somebody didn't pay attention to the right details or didn't have some sort of framework to think about the solution that they're making. And again, this is why putting the human at the center is so important. And our actual position at IBM is that AI is to augment humans. It's not to replace them. And I think that attitudinally coupled with practices that you should and could follow as a part of the design process helps to keep that ethical conversation, not just in the forefront, but as a part of the fabric of everything that we do from the conception of the idea to the time that it gets sunset. And I think that's really important. I can't stress how important enough it is to have ethics in design for AI. That's something we're very proud of and very actively involved in.
Love it. All right, Adam, we talked about a bunch of stuff today. It was awesome. If you were going to have the designers listening here who were trying to make a bigger strategic impact, do two things differently tomorrow based on what we talked about today, what would you say?
Wow, there's a lot. We covered a lot of ground. I mean, I think the first one is to stop thinking of yourself as a member of a quote unquote design team, that you need to be part of a whole team, that successful design is not the be all end all. It is the entire product. The design is one aspect of it. The infrastructure takes part in it. The planning of it, the product management takes part in that. Like there's much more than just the design. So we have to see ourselves as being part of a whole team and that we are capable in that whole team construct of being able to articulate to others the importance of design, but also that there is a shared intent that we all have, that we can all recite from heart, and that our role in this is not to make things look pretty, but to help conceive, articulate, and champion that intent, both for the business and the end user. I think that's super important. I think the other thing is, if you feel like you're fighting against your organization to be heard, stop fighting and get smart. Approach this like a design problem and design your way into the place that you want to be. And this is not easy, and sometimes it takes years and there are setbacks. And as a part of that, one thing that we learned early on in our transformation process was kill your babies, like at the height of their popularity. Like it doesn't make any intuitive sense, but every time we reached some new plateau, we ended up taking away what we were doing and replaced it with something better. So as the desire and the groundswell came up behind, say, we did all these boot camps around design thinking for people, for teams that were already in flight. And I did some back of the envelope math, and I figured out that if we kept doing it at the rate and the pace that we were doing, A, it would kill the team delivering it. B, it would take us somewhere around 29 years to hit everybody that we needed to hit. So then we decided, so right when it was at the height of its popularity and we had people banging down our door to get into this program to come down here to Austin, we stopped doing it and we retooled the entire team and then sent them on the road. So we went to all the biggest IBM sites around the world and we did them for, like, you know, instead of groups of 20 or 30 people, we were doing them for like 400 people. And we did that for a year. And when it got to the height of that, we took that away and we moved everything online and created an entire online training platform that everybody across the entire company could take at any time. And so it was this constant reinvention. It's not about sitting on your laurels based on the win that you have today. It's about figuring out what needs to be done right now. And when it's outlived its purpose, or you feel yourself or your team getting content, that's when you need to change it. Because when we get content, we get lazy. And then we start building expectations around being content. And that doesn't help anybody. So be brave and be willing to put in that effort. But think of how, if design isn't respected wherever you work, think about it as a design problem. Think about who your users are, who's your audience to hear the message that you need to get across, and make sure that your message, the idea of design that you need to get across, is not one that is self-serving, but that it is benefiting everybody in the company as well as your customers.
Use those design skills that you have to help with this problem, right?
Exactly, right.
Awesome. Adam, it has been an immense pleasure. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us on our design chat today.
Thanks for having me. That was a ton of fun, and I'll do it again in a heartbeat.
Excellent. All right, you guys heard that here. We will have him on again later. All right. Thank you, everyone. Have a great rest of the week. Thanks.